Welcome to The Bigger Podcast, the show that goes behind the scenes of greenkeeping and golf course management. Each episode will bring you insight and inspiration from the people shaping the future of greenkeeping, from apprentices to course managers and from industry leaders to innovators. Whether you work in greenkeeping, the wider golf industry, or you just love the game, this podcast will give you a deeper understanding of greenkeepers and greenkeeping. We are Bigger, the British and International Golf Greenkeepers Association, and we'll bring you everything you need to know about the people who make golf and great golf courses possible. Welly Open is one of the biggest events in golf, but long before the first tee shot is struck, there's years of work behind the scenes to prepare the course. And for the first episode of the Bigger Podcast, we speak to Royal Birkdale course manager Sean McLean. As a Southport venue hosts the best golfers on the planet this week, Sean discusses what it's taken to deliver one of the most significant redevelopment projects in the club's history, and what it means to prepare one of the sport's most iconic courses for the Open. Here's Sean McLean.
Sean, a very warm welcome to the first, the Bigger Podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Really looking forward to this chat. I imagine it's a crazy time for you right now. As we record this, it's days before the Open at Royal Birkdale. How are things going down at the soon-to-be Open venue?
Yeah, so far, it's been going well, actually. Just we're navigating, you know, contractors and different weather patterns and heat stress, you know, for turf and, you know, ourselves included. So, we're navigating everything. But, you know, by and large, everything's went quite well, really, all things considered. So we're in a good place. What we're now, we're pretty much within 2 weeks out. There's plenty of contractors around. We got through the sort of heat stress of last week, which was, you know, always testing for anyone, whether you're hosting an Open or not. We were just kind of trying to keep on top of everything, keep everyone happy at the moment, and then look to sort of, you know, push the course if we can in the next few weeks leading up to the Open.
We are going to talk, I would imagine, in some detail about the weather later on, and we will get firmly into the Open and all the work that's been going on at Royal Birkdale, because it's been a hugely busy time for you, I think, since you took charge. I think for those who aren't aware of you, Sean, and I'm sure there aren't many among your bigger colleagues, but for those who aren't, just take us through your career, if you could, and how you've ended up as the course manager for the Open venue in a week or so.
Yeah, so pretty much done greenkeeping all my working life, really. I all started when I'd done a work experience from secondary school, done a week at Murrayfield Golf Club, which is just up the hill from where I grew up. And, you know, from there, just kind of fell in love with it. Had no really ties to golf or greenkeeping in any way, shape or form. Done a week at Murrayfield in the winter, which, you know, you think you would probably never come back to that, but here I am now. So and then that started. I done an apprenticeship through Oakridge College at Craigmillar Park in Edinburgh, done my time there, which, you know, that's places like Craigmillar Park, you know, great golf courses, but, you know, five staff, you know, that's where you, I felt like that's actually wherever I've been lucky enough to work, that's actually where you ground yourself and you learn the most, really, because you have to be able to do pretty much everything because there's no option. So that was cool. Then Craigmillar Park, you know, then I've obviously done the Ohio State program, moved on to do the Ohio State program, spent 18 months in America, some great experiences at Oak Hill and Southern Hills, Australia, working down at Huntingdale in Melbourne, done sort of 6 months in Australia, and then was lucky enough to come back, work at Archerfield, Turnberry for the 09 Open. And then I was lucky enough to get the job down at Prince's and spent 13 years down at Prince's after moving around quite a lot in a short space of time, just to really gain experience, which I thought was, you know, I always thought with golf courses, there's so many golf courses in the world, we can do this anywhere if we want. So go and gain a bit of experience and a bit of life experience as well, which is probably always important. And then from there, spent 13 years at Prince's, you know, worked up to course manager. And then, we've done loads of construction, loads of renovations. And then obviously was lucky enough to get the opportunity to come to Birkdale, and here I am now.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we'll get into the project at Birkdale, which was enormous. But I mean, that time at Prince's, there was huge development, wasn't there? The kind of redevelopment of the Himalayas, and then obviously Shaw and Dunes afterwards. I mean, that what a massive project to be involved in. How much experience did that give you as well, do you think, for what we're about to subsequently talk about at Birkdale?
Yeah, massive experience, really. What started out with, you know, the plan to renovate the Himalayas nine, it just, you know, grew arms and legs and then expanded into the shore and the dunes. Once you get confidence, you know, with what you're doing, and the ownership get confidence with what you're doing and, you know, what's being produced, then it kind of makes it a little bit easier. But the experience again at Prince's was massive and had a big bearing on what was, and confidence in what you're able to achieve, you know, especially at Birkdale. So we've done a lot of things in-house at Prince's as well, which meant you had to learn and you had to figure it out. You know, there's problem solving all the way along the way in construction, whether you like it or not, it's just part of it. Once you've opened a can of worms, it's just the way it is. You need to figure it out. So, yeah, you're just learning as you go along. And, yeah, look, you need to just deal with the problems as they come across.
And the reaction to that work as well has been phenomenal, hasn't it? I mean, Prince's, if you look at ranking lists, for example, has risen massively, hasn't it, in the last few years?
Yeah, rankings list, and obviously Walker Cup in 2030 as well. So it shows you that all the hard work pays off. And I think when you put that much effort into it, like everyone did, all the staff and the ownership putting their you know, the funds into it as well, it's satisfying when something like that pays off and you can see it getting better year on year, and obviously getting awarded with having the Walker Cups and final qualifyings and, you know, all different kind of events. It makes it worthwhile.
And from your perspective then, as a course manager and as a greenkeeper, I mean, what do you learn from projects like that? Is it technical? Is it emotional? Is it management? Is it teamwork? Is it all of those things?
All of the above. It's you need to learn how to navigate all problems, whether it be technical problems, it could be irrigation, you know, whether it be, you know, dealing with the weather that influences you. You know, you can have the best laid plans in the world, but you need to be able to be flexible to manoeuvre around weather patterns or things going wrong. Or, you know, for example, one of the challenges here at Birkdale that we had was the irrigation maps weren't as accurate as what we thought. So tying into the existing irrigation was quite a painful process. But lucky enough, I think all you can do is prepare and have good contractors on side. And you need to know that there's going to be difficult times and accept that that's just part and parcel of construction. But yeah, there is the emotional side of it, because they're long days, you know. They're tiresome days, and some days are good, and you're going to have bad days during construction. Not everything's going to go to plan, or sometimes the weather's not going to play ball, or, you know, whether a delivery is late or doesn't turn up, or, you know, with the best will in the world, things like that happen. You just need to learn how to deal with it. So that's kind of the learning curve, and being able to take these some things on the chin and just, you know, power through them almost.
Yeah, and obviously you worked with Mackenzie and Ebert at Prince's, principally with Martin Ebert, and then obviously with Tom Mackenzie at Roll Birkdale. So let's get into this project before we start talking about the open, because it was enormous. And I wonder if you've had much sleep, actually, over the last couple of years. I know people will say to you, what are the hours like now? But really, I mean, you've been full throttle for a good couple of years now, haven't you, with this project?
Yeah, it's been... it's funny, everyone says, oh, you mustn't sleep very well. I always sleep very well, actually. Just I think, you know, you put so much effort in it that I always sleep very well, and that's never a problem. But you're always putting there's so much effort into it. It was an enormous project to take on, but everyone, because the greenkeeping staff took a lot on as well. So, you know, it's dealing with contractors, and you spend, you know, at one point during the construction, there was about 7 different contractors on site that you're having to deal with, you know, never mind the open, that was before the open. So it's been 3 years of, you know, planning and preparation and then actually executing it. We achieved a lot in a short space of time. It was an ambitious project, but, and, you know, and again, we always go back to the weather. It's not been easy the last couple of years. We had drought last year, and then phase one was actually a particularly wet finish to phase one. So again, you just need to learn how to deal with these things.
Yeah, so just to go through some of the main changes at Royal Birkdale for listeners who might not be aware of it. Obviously, you've got a new par 3, which plays as the 15th. Previous par 5 15th has been redesigned as a new 14th hole. Previous 14th green has been converted into a short game area. The 5th hole has been completely redesigned. The 7th has been redesigned. That's now a short par 3 with a raised green. Every bunker, tee and pathway on the course has been renovated. And you've also removed some bunkers as well during that process. I mean, it's huge. How much of this project was done with the Open in mind, and how much was it for the betterment of the club? What was the members' feedback, and what led to it?
So the primary driver of this was membership driven, you know, so that was that's what it really was for. But obviously with Opens coming up, you need to bear these things in mind. And that's the difficulty of, you know, for an architect, for us being Tom McKenzie, is trying to tie it together for being, you know, favourable for members, but also proving a big enough test for an Open Championship or any major championship, you know. So that's really, you know, that was one of the, you know, a part of it. But it's always been members driven, this. So the Open was going to be coming to Birkdale regardless of the changes. So yeah, what happened really is the members gave Tom a brief, and then Tom, you know, produced a master plan document based on that brief. And then, you know, the members voted on how much of it to do, if any at all. And that's where we ended up, you know, going through this process. And what happened really was the timing of the Open kind of dictated when we were going to do it, because we either had the option of doing nothing before an Open or doing everything. Or what would have been a bit weird would have been doing bits and pieces of it. You kind of had to do all or nothing. And then if you had done bits and pieces, then, you know, you would have went through two phases of work and then an Open, and then you would have been, everyone would have just had, you know, contractor exhaustion, for lack of a better term, you know. So I think we've done the right thing and, you know, and taking it all on in two phases. I mean, I would say we've probably done three phases of work in two. That's realistically what we've done. So that is kind of how these decisions came about. So the Open was, it's always in the back of your mind and you're always working together with the RNA. But realistically, a lot of the changes that we've done were for improvements of the course from a member's point of view.
Yeah, take me through those phases then, Sean, if you could, and how you tackled them. I think in the first one, I think which started September 23, if I'm right, that's when you built the new green. So take me through the phases and how that work developed.
Well, phase one was the starting point was always going to be to get the greens that were going to be changing, rebuilt and relayed. So phase one was holes 5, 7 and 14 to 18. The new holes, or the holes that changed the most with the greens construction, well, putting green 5, 7, 14 and 15. But because 14 and 15, you lost that connection in the winter, we just decided to do 14 to 18 and complete the holes in phase one. So that was basically phase one, was that was the major part of the work. And then phase two was basically all the other holes and all the other tees and paths, which was just, if anything, that was, it was just as hard, if not harder, because there was a lot more bitty stuff to do, you know, like tees and paths and, you know, all the bunker and the rest of the bunkering to do as well. And then, you know, we decided to throw some drainage work in on top of that as well. So some major drainage work on the 6th hole, the 2nd and the 3rd, which were notoriously wet in the winter. And just to try and improve the sward composition, especially on 6, which is our lowest lying hole. So we threw that in the mix as well as, you know, rebuilding, which old 14, which is rebuilding the whole short game area. And adding another green onto that. So we threw that into the mixture as, you know, along with our normal day-to-day greenkeeping duties as well, preparing for an Open. So it was full on.
Yeah, I imagine we must be talking about quite significant movements of land, of soil, of things like that.
Yeah, there is. But what's clever about it is you're always trying to, you know, work with cut and fill areas, you know, so you're always trying to take material from one area to another, which is what the architects do quite well, actually. They're always trying to make it as minimal disturbance and minimal. Moving earths costs money, so the less you have to do it, the better. So if we can work within or the areas we have, that's where the architects, that's probably the things that people don't see with architecture. And what the architects do is all the planning on the earth movement and what goes from here A to B, and how can we, you know, reduce all the movements of earth. For example, when we rebuilt all the T's, we didn't have grass paths here. So to generate enough material for the paths, we stripped the T's turf, we used that as revetting turf, and then we actually cut the soil, the T's soil, with sand to generate enough, well, to cut it primarily to dilute it, because it was always quite heavy. So by doing that, we diluted it, which we just solved one problem with a lot of worm casts, but also generated enough material for root zone for the paths. So things like that all have a, you know, that's actually what a lot of the, most of the planning goes into, is finding all these, you know, generating soil. I mean, if you look at the whole project that we done at Birkdale over the two phases and all the earth we moved, we didn't buy 1 ton of soil. We didn't buy a ton at all. So everything was in-house and everything was, you know, reused or diluted or regenerated, or screened and reused as well. You know, some of the old years old tip, we screened that and reused that for some root zone. So not 1 ton was bought in the whole project of root zone. So it's quite an impressive feat when you think about it like that from a design point of view.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic. I imagine I've seen the weather. There was some variable weather, to say the least, wasn't there, over these 2 years? I mean, obviously, kind of flooding one year and a drought another year. I mean, how did the project cope with that? I know it has to, because these things need to get built, but still, you know, we've gone through incredibly wet winters and incredibly dry summers over the past couple of years. That is an enormous challenge.
Yeah. So the challenge in phase one was it was wetter than ideal. And the hardest part of it, it's not so bad if it's kind of a bit wetter when you're in the middle of the phase one, because you've got other areas you can go to. You know what I mean? You can kind of go, right, well, we'll leave that area because it's a bit wetter, so we'll go and work on another area. But when we got to the end of phase one and we were down to just re-turfing the fifth fairway and it's still heavens opening, then you're trying to, you know, you're trying to prepare areas and lay turf and install irrigation in less than ideal conditions. That's what makes it tough, when you're kind of backed into a corner a little bit. And we were prepping areas and laying turf and not ideal conditions, but sometimes you need to just kind of push the boundaries a little bit to get these projects over the line. So yeah, it was just, you know, everyone thinks links courses, you know, they drain well, you've never got a problem with drainage, but there is some lower lying areas in Birkdale that are a little bit wetter, and the fifth fairway is actually just quite heavy soil. I think Birkdale imported a lot of soil when it was built, so that heavier soil, as soon as you started to work it, it just, you know, lost all its stability. So it was just a case of, we actually ended up, you know, doing a lot of sections by hand, turfing areas by hand, just because you couldn't get machinery on it. So then phase two was just basically from January, was quite wet actually in 25. I think we got about 100 odd mil of rain, and then from February till August, it was so dry, I can't remember the numbers, but that's probably, I'd say that's harder than being wet, just because you've got so much young turf out there that it's just difficult to try and keep on top of it all. So yeah, and especially what was happening was we were laying turf in sort of February, March, April time, and rainfall was just not giving you a break, so you're watering, you're hand watering, which obviously takes people away from doing other things. So that's where, you know, the best will in the world, or the best planning in the world, you know, if that's going to be a reality, which is always a chance that it can happen, but yeah, you just need to kind of push these things through.
How tough was that period? I mean, I can't imagine the difficulty of trying to establish new turf when it basically isn't raining. Were you at risk of turf failing at any point, or were you thinking about alternatives if you couldn't get it to take?
You're always, in the grand scheme of things, we didn't lose a lot of turf. There wasn't many areas that we re-turfed. I mean, you're talking about square metres, a couple of small sections on the fringes, if you like. But all in all, you know, good wetting agents, good irrigation system, and having, you know, good greenkeeping staff to actually look after these things, you know, that's where it helps. So yeah, that's what really helps. So we just need to, it's difficult, but you just need to keep planning, and you know, you just need to get in the trench really and actually, you know, try and make it work somehow. So there was a lot of, like I say, good wetting agents is probably your best friend there, because that's, you get what you get what you pay for in that respect, that you actually can rely upon these things, and they give you a little bit of help along the way. Obviously they don't replace water, but yeah, that's just you need to kind of lean back on these things if you like.
If you're enjoying this episode and would like to put your organisation in front of our audience, then we'd love to hear from you. Podcast sponsorship is a great way to support the work we do while reaching an engaged community of greenkeeping professionals as well as the wider turf industry. To find out more about sponsorship opportunities, please contact our team by email on sales@bigger.co.uk.
How has that carried on into 2026? Because I don't know what the weather was like specifically in the northwest. I'm hoping you can tell me. But where I am in Yorkshire, it was a particularly wet winter, which has then gone into heat bombs over the last few weeks, with another one set to come. I mean, again, you know, you've established new turf. I imagine that turf, you know, is still settling down. How have you managed to cope with that over the last few months?
So yeah, we didn't. You know what? It wasn't actually, I wouldn't say it was a wet winter in the northwest. I think other areas like yourselves in the south have actually been a lot wetter than us. I think we're standing at about 280 mil of rain for the year, which is not a lot for the northwest. People told me it rained here, but I'm yet to see it, even though phase one did prove me wrong. But yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's the young turf that, you know, it takes years to build resilience in the turf. So yeah, there is younger turf out there it's not as established and it's not as resilient as the older stuff, you know, that's been there for, you know, tens of years, hundreds of years. So again, you're just looking at preventative programs of wetting agents and, you know, fertilizers where needed. You know, you're just trying to plan and look after these areas. These areas always just need a little bit extra TLC, and that's the reality of young turf, you know, especially when it's coming off a turf nursery somewhere in Lincolnshire that's, you know, fed more than we would ever feed it, just because that's the part of the process of growing a turf nursery or growing turf. So you're just always trying to kind of give it what it needs, but at the same time wean it off to try and, you know, establish it as Lynx turf.
Yeah. How much of this work was done in-house with you and your team, and how much of it was done by contractors?
So the greenkeeping team rebuilt all the bunkers. So there's 106 bunkers that were all rebuilt in two phases. If you include the practice area, it's probably more like 112 maybe. So the bunkers were all rebuilt, which the greenkeeper stripped the tees turf to use as revetting, which is then used to reuse to build the bunkers. And then we, the greenkeepers also, in phase one, we turfed some of the paths, but then we flipped it over in phase two just to suit us a little bit better from a timing point of view, that the greenkeepers turfed all the tees, and that just kind of seemed to work really, if we turfed the tees and then the contractors turfed the paths out. And then, yeah, obviously all the aftercare is done by the greenkeepers as well, and then in phase two, it was really the drainage project that was added in as well, that was all reinstated by the greenkeepers, which is quite a big project down on the 2, 3 and 6 and 13 as well, actually. So the reinstatement of that was quite a big challenge. But again, it's bearing fruit now, you know, or in the winter it's bearing fruit. It's a hole that, you know, would potentially have standing water on it for a big chunk of a wet period. Now pretty much doesn't. Or when it does rain and you get a little bit, you get heavy rain and it does have standing water, it doesn't last for very long. So again, it's all paying off. So that was generally what the greenkeeper's done, along with, you know, preparing for an open, which is always interesting.
Yeah, imagine a hugely rewarding project to be part of as well. I mean, you're kind of changing history, aren't you? I know Royal Birkdale is a course that has historically been altered down the years. I mean, the 12th, for example, was put in the 1960s, isn't it? So it's not like the golf course is a museum piece by any stretch, but still a brilliant project to be involved in.
Yeah, I know. I think that's one thing that people maybe forget, you know, that you know you shouldn't touch Birkdale, but it's actually been changed a decent amount since it was formed, and since it moved to this site. Like I said, it changed in 1910, then the 1930s, it changed a lot. And throughout the years, like I said, the 12th, there used to be a par 3 17th, and then that's when the 12th was created, and that dropped out. So it's changed a decent bit, but I'd like to think they don't just change for the sake of changing. It's always done with the membership in mind, especially this time. The membership are kept in mind, and it's to keep it relevant. And it almost like, you know, if you've got redundant bunkers, then there's no need to keep them, things like that. Why don't we just keep it relevant is probably the best word I would use for it. So yeah, it's changed a lot. It's but yeah, hopefully I'd like to think we've made it better, which was already a great course. I think we've made the weaker holes better.
Yeah, and bunkers, I mean, obviously you took some out. I mean, bunkers are a big talking point, aren't they, in golf at the moment, particularly around sustainability and people hours in terms of raking them and maintaining them. What were your thoughts then on renovating those bunkers in the way that you did and taking some of them out?
So the idea, the ones that we were taking out, you know, the ones that we took out were, it was a no-brainer really. We ended up taking out about 20 bunkers. But the only thing we ended up doing was the bunkers that we have created are bigger. So sand area-wise, we're probably about the same, if not a little bit more. So we probably tried to make them a little bit more natural looking, I would say. You know, let the wind blow the sand. But unfortunately, the wind blows the sand quite extensively sometimes. So that's more man hours to put it back in place. So we're probably at a point now where the major work's done. I would say that, you know, we will... After the Open, you will look at, you know, is there bunkers? How did it play? How's it been playing for the membership for the last 2 years? Are there bunkers that we don't need? So I think that's always your first protocol. Does a bunker need to be there? And if it does, I don't think there's many bunkers that don't need to be there anymore. But we might look at, you know, how can we improve it from a sand blow point of view? Like some of the bunkers just get emptied the sand when it's really windy. So, you know, that's probably what we'll be looking at fine-tuning. And I think you're always just trying to buy time with bunkers, aren't you? They're such a controversial hazard, but at the same time, they're still a hazard. So I was in the mindset that we can try and make them as natural as we can, but also we know that we need to maintain them to a point because, you know, golfers aren't a big fan of them either. And yeah, it's trying to make them more playable, but at the same time, as little input as possible.
Have you had chance to take a stock of the work yet and appreciate what's been happened? I know there'd be a tendency, wouldn't there, to sort of look ahead to the Open and see how it all plays during the Open and then evaluate it afterwards. But ultimately, Royal Birkdale's a members club, isn't it, with huge visitor play. So it's rank and file golfers who are as important as anyone else, really, aren't they, in how that work is perceived?
Yeah, and no is the answer to that. Probably not. You probably always like to think you would, and you know, you think like we've had a winter of no construction just there, but you're just as busy. You're all, you know, with the open of mind, and you're always tweaking, especially after a couple of years of construction, especially a project like that. The winter after, you'll kind of target the tweaks. You were like, maybe never got quite that bunker right, or that didn't quite work. I mean, I don't think there was much of that. There's not much of that at Birkdale, but there's always something. There's always something. So I don't think I have time, really had time to reflect. And probably this winter, maybe it'll hit me. But yeah, at the end of the day, what you said about the membership there is bob on, really. You know, we don't want, inevitably you are going to peak for an Open because you're going to increase your frequency cut in and you're going to have 50 guys. That's not normal daily golf. But we want to get to the point where you don't have to peak for an Open. It's just, you know, all you're doing is increasing your frequency to cut. We want to be good for the members and visitors all the time, so that's the goal. And that's even, you know, the Open, it's great that we're having the Open and obviously we're all excited, but I'm just as excited about after the Open because there's so much more work to do at Birkdale that, you know, and it might not be all the big stuff that like we've done, but there's loads of behind the scenes stuff, and there's loads of other good ideas that we've got along the way.
You run a few autonomous mowers, I think, at Royal Birkdale, is that correct?
Yes.
Will we see any of these at the Open? I know that at the AIG Women's Open at Royal Pothole last year, I think there was 15 used. Yeah. And that was the first time they'd ever been used at a major championship. How do you employ autonomous mowers, and will we see any of them when the Open comes?
No, we won't see any of the Open, purely just logistically. You know, we've got a massive tournament support here from John Deere, so we'll be using the John Deere machinery. But at the same time, you could have done it with the autonomous mowers, but realistically, when you've got that many volunteers in that tournament support, we can cut the fairways in probably 3 hours. So it's just a lot easier. If you've got like a dew in the morning, for example, we're just going to cut it off. And it just, with everything that's been going on the last 2 or 3 years, I was like, that's one thing I don't need to worry about, you know what I mean? So it is possible, and obviously Ian done a great job at Porthcawl Wet, and it can be possible, but it was just a little bit too far for us, and I was more comfortable just knowing that we're sending the mowers out there to take care of that job, and I don't need to worry about it, you know what I mean? So yeah, we do use them on fairways throughout the year. But we do still have cylinder mowers that we kind of polish them off with as well. I think the best combination is both, if you're lucky enough to have both. We kept our old fairy mowers, and we still run the cylinders over them now and again. So if you're lucky enough to have both, that's the ideal. But at the same time, you can't argue that, you know, if you're cutting with just robots or just cylinders, you can get, I've always said, an 8 out of 10 if you're using one or the other. But if you use both together, you can get a 10 out of 10.
Do you get different types of cut with them? Yeah. I mean, do you get different grades, different distinctions in plant?
Yeah, so what you'll get with this, with the robots, because it's a rotary type mower, you know, you obviously get that rotary type scything action, which is, you know, a lot of people know what I'm talking about when you talk about the stalks that you get, the ryegrass stalks and the sort of spring. You don't get any of that. And you get that, it almost lifts the turf up, you know, it always stands the turf up. So it's just a different cut in action. It's almost, you can almost say it's like brushing them almost. It just stands everything up, so it makes everything grow vertically. And then with the cylinder mower, obviously you get that roll with it, but you also get that cylinder action. So they're different types of cuts, so they aren't the same, but at the same time, you know, you can cut fairways with both, or, you know, one or the other.
Well, let's come on to the Open then for the final part of the podcast. I mean, how are you feeling ahead of it? It's obviously been a lot of work over the past 2 or 3 years in terms of the project. It's like one of the longest leads in I think you could probably ever have to a tournament. You know, you tend to know, or Birkdale have known for some time, obviously, that the Open will be coming there. How are you feeling about it as we are basically on the cusp of it happening?
I'm excited about it. You know, I want to make sure that I enjoy it. But I've got to say, the last 2 months is just, I don't even know where it's went. And I think, like you touched on the weather earlier, I think the weather plays a big part in that. Like I said, we've had two heat stress weeks. And then in between that, mixed weather. So there's always that, you know, you lose 2 weeks of, like, especially last week, you weren't doing anything. No practices last week. We didn't even cut at the end of the week. It was just a case of watering. So, you know, all the plans that you have, whether it be brushing or a bit of grooming, that just went out of the window last week, you know what I mean? So it kind of just has a knock-on effect to what you've got planned. So, yeah, I'm excited, but, you know, I don't really have time to think about it, to be honest. You're just, you know, living in the moment almost. And then trying to take it all in and appreciate all the cool stuff that's going on. We like this, you know, you see the players start to arrive for practice rounds, but there's so many small details to figure out, like, you know, with for example, the tournament support, getting the units set up right, and all the fine details that go with that, and the bunkering, you know, what are we doing with bunkering, and, you know, then the wind blows and you get a dry, you get, like last week, for example, was just thinking about keeping everything happy. And nothing else mattered. Nothing else matters when the course is, you know, needs your attention. That's, at the end of the day, that's what we're all here for. So I think it's just a case of, yeah, excited, but living in the moment almost, because that's all you've got time for.
What do you think the week will look like for you? I mean, where do you see yourself being? How many volunteers will you have? How many staff will you have on hand?
So there's going to be about 47 staff in total that week. I'll just kind of be, you know, obviously the agronomists will be here, so there'll be a lot of discussions and just keeping an eye on things. And I'll almost just be walking the course or sweeping the course and keeping an eye on things and being available to make decisions with, you know, with Adam Newton or whoever we're working with, and me and Scott with EPO sit down and we'll be going over, just reviewing everything every day. So you're spending a lot of time just tinkering and tweaking and keeping an eye on things, really. And obviously you get an influx of people that, some people might know the site, but an influx of, you know, like 30 guys that don't know the site or don't know the site well and they don't know the machinery potentially, making sure that all runs well. So we're actually bringing people in a little bit earlier for volunteering, just because we want them to get a little bit more comfortable with the site and with the machinery. So and what you've got this year is you've got the Monday last chance qualifier, so that's quite a big day now, even though it's still a practice day, which is still a big day, but hopefully by the Monday we'll be up and running and everyone will be on the same page.
Yeah, because there's a place up for grabs, isn't there? So for those players who are taking part in it, it's serious stuff, isn't it?
Yeah. So you've got the Monday last chance qualifier. Obviously, you've got the Scottish Open next week where you have people qualifying. So, yeah, it makes it more interesting. I can see the appeal of it. It's going to be quite cool to have that.
Long hours. I think everyone who's listened to this podcast who's ever held a tournament at all, you know, of any sort of size, will understand that. I mean, I know there are extremes at the Open. You very early starts and probably quite late finishes. I mean, how will you keep going through that? How will you keep your team going through that? Because I mean, I know as someone who's reported on the Open, you know, you start to get into later in the week and there's a natural fatigue that just comes in.
Yeah. I always found like by the Friday's the hard day. You kind of become a zombie by the Friday. So another thing that we're lucky enough to have here is we've got 30 artisans that help us out. So they can take a little bit of the weight for like the divot in the evening. So what that's meant is we can, you know, obviously subject to change with weather and whatever's going on, we can try and do a little bit of a rota for the boys and try and give them at least a night off. You know what I mean? So, because we'll need people on call during the week and the afternoons just in case something happens. But we're trying to do some kind of rota system that at least will give people a little bit of a break. And then when it comes to myself and Scott will kind of try and take an afternoon. We'll rotate afternoons, and now, you know, one of us will try and get away in the afternoon for a few hours to at least get a little bit of kip, or just a change of scenery sometimes just gives you a little bit of a breather, doesn't it? So get out of that sort of cabin fever. So that's the plan. But like I say, plans are great, but yeah, dealing with them on the ground is another thing.
Temptation is going to be to watch golf, isn't it?
yeah. And we've got what we've done actually this year is quite cool. So we've got the tent for the volunteers. That's like, we're quite restricted for space here at Birkdale at the moment, which is another long-term project. But we've got the tent and we're going to have a sort of games room set up, and we're going to have a darts board and an F1 simulator, which Terralift are going to be, and Aitkins are kind of sponsoring. They're putting a games room on, which is going to have sort of table football, darts, F1 simulator, an Xbox. I mean, we're limited with space. I was trying to get a pool table in there, but it wasn't quite going to work. So, you know what, just something to take people's minds off the golf and the golf course. And then Bernard's are going to do a bit of a presentation for us as well in one afternoon. So, we're just trying to kind of make it, you know, you are allowed to try and enjoy the week as well. You know, it doesn't always have to be in the trenches. You know, we're going to be long hours, split shifts, especially the Thursday, Friday are tough because you've got the long days. But with the artisans' help, hopefully we can spread the sort of weight a little bit.
So what are you looking at there on, I mean, obviously it's dawn till dusk, basically, Thursday and Friday, isn't it? So many players getting round. I mean, you know, I've been there when players are finishing at like 10 o'clock and they're starting, obviously, I think at 6:30. So how does that day work for you? I mean, is it kind of like a 3:30 alarm and then are you carrying on in the dark, kind of floodlights everywhere and just trying to get the work done?
Pretty much. So the morning shift will be starting, the plan is to start, get into the tent for 4:15 and then out on the course for 4:00. And then your morning shift will last till about 10 o'clock. And you know, there's food put on, there's catering put on for the guys, so they'll get their breakfast. And then the afternoon, what we'll do is we'll have probably about 15 guys on standby, which we'll try and rotate throughout the day. But again, you know, they can still probably go on the course and watch golf. It's just a case of being available, which will be more weather dependent. Then in the evenings, we'll have guys come back. The problem is you don't want to be coming back too early. There's no point, because you'll just catch the last group. So you need to stay two holes or three holes back. So we'll probably be coming back at about 5 o'clock, having dinner, head out onto the course. Once we've got the ninth hole right next to us, so probably once golf's cleared the ninth, that's when we'll go out onto the first and then sweep round. And then we'll Thursday, Friday, you'll be waiting on them, especially Friday. So that's just, you just expect that. And then the Saturday, Sunday's actually a little bit more friendly if all goes well.
So I imagine you're quite into your weather, and there's some warm weather coming. We don't know quite how warm it's going to be. I mean, opinions are divided at the moment. Some forecasts say we've got another heat bomb coming, and others say it'll be a bit mixed. I mean, obviously, you are in the lap of the gods when it comes to the weather. You can't control that. You can predict it, but you can't control it. How would you like the course to be looking on open week when we start on that Monday? I mean, my ideal, it's personal opinion, is, you know, I look back to glorious opens and I think of Carnoustie a few years ago, and I think of Hoylake going back to 06, and I love these kind of browned off golf courses, but I appreciate beauty is in the eye of the beholder. So I mean, how would you like to see your turf performing when it kicks off?
I think when, like you just said, when you think about Carnoustie and even the old course in 22, I think it was. I think, yeah, you do. It does look good. Links courses look at their best when they're, you know, browned off a little bit. So I would say the only thing for me at this point is we've still got a lot of young turf out there. So to be proper browns, not all, I think we'd be fine, but you know, you're just pushing the you're pushing boundaries. So I'd like to be linksy is probably the best way to put it, but you know, we need to be careful with how far we push some of our younger turf, if you like. But yeah, I think we all want it to be playing firm and fast, and that's still the goal.
And one of the things I imagine that some of our listeners might not realise is, you know, when the Open finishes on the Sunday and you've been involved in the winners' presentation and the winners hoisting the claret jug, that's all fantastic. But then over the coming weeks, stands come down and you've got to try and reinstate the golf course, which, I mean, I was at Birkdale in 2017. I was lucky enough to play it a few weeks after Jordan Spieth had won the Open there, and I was surprised actually at kind of some of the work that needs doing, and it was by no means, you know, out of the ordinary. I mean, what do you look at in terms of time of recovery when the stands start coming down and the attention moves away?
So the plan is that the D-rig will be finished on the course anyway by the first week in September. So it's quite a prompt rip out. Then after that, I think, to be fair, I think at Birkdale, a lot of the stuff or most of the structures are in rough areas. So they're not really playing surfaces. You know, you think about like Portrush or St Andrews or Troon, where they're actually using other courses that have structures on them. We're quite lucky in that respect. There's not much fine turf here that we're going to have to reinstate. Actually, the biggest area is probably on our short game area that they put a stand on or put a structure on. So yeah, I think we're quite lucky that the rough areas, look, it depends on what kind of autumn you get, but there is a plan in place for, you know, reseeding, re-turfing where needed. The biggest area is actually because our driving range is going to, as the village where the shop is, the practice tee will probably take the longest time to recover. So just because there's a couple of structures on it. So these are the things that, yeah, depending on the weather, but there's a sort of restitution plan that we'll all go round and everything gets, we'll try and help it as much as we can. But yeah, depending on the autumn that we get, it's who knows. And actually, when you look at some of the rough areas where people will be walking, spectators walk, some of it actually does it a favour with the spectators. They kind of thin it out a little bit. So in a way, every 10 years, 9, 10 years, whenever it comes round, the rough actually gets a little bit of a sort of scarify. It's great. So I don't know. I don't actually look at it as all a negative.
Come and play it straight afterwards by the sound of it then. I mean, you'll be busy, right? I mean, it won't be too long after the claret jug is hoisted that you'll be back into member and visitor play. I mean, what are the differences between the golf course we'll see for the Open and what you would do anyway at Royal Birkdale for the people who come and play there? Is it vastly different in terms of heights of cut and so on, or is it quite a similar thing?
Not really. I mean, like I said to you earlier, it's really, we want to get to the point where all we're really doing is increasing frequency of cut. It's frequency of cut which really polishes everything. So when it comes to setup, it's not really going to be changing very much. You know, we dealt with a lot of the issues that we had during the master plan work, during the construction phase. So they're just really, frequency cutting is the main thing that you're doing during them, because you've got the, well, you've got the machinery as one, and you've got the staff to do it. So if we all had 50 staff, we'd all, you know, we could all do a great, you know, a fantastic job. So it's a case of frequency cut. But beyond that, yeah, it's not, there's not much more to it. I mean, it comes to sort of, you know, cutting heights or whatever. Again, we just want it to be, you know, not much more than what we set up for normal. So when it comes to sort of green sites or whatever, it's all dependent on the weather. You know, like yesterday, for example, on the fifth hole, you know, greens are performing quite well at the moment, you know, and the balls, you know, it was windy. It was probably, you know, like gusting 25, and, you know, the ball's starting to move. You know, doesn't take much to tip it over the edge on a links course. So I don't think we'll need to be pushing it too much more to get the numbers that we need to.
Who wins? Who would you like to see win?
The obvious answer, sort of, obviously Tommy Fleetwood, being a local guy, grew up literally down the road. But, you know, even like Bob McIntyre would be good to see him get one over the line. You're just hoping for a good winner, aren't you? But I think Tommy would be, I think, you know, you couldn't be disappointed with Tommy. That'd be a good one if he was coming online. But that's an easy answer for me to say.
Well, the eyes of the world will be on Royal Birkdale at the Open. I'm sure it's going to be a fabulous watch. I'm sure all our listeners are looking forward to seeing the new course on television, or if they're lucky to attend in person as well. Best of luck. Thanks for joining us, Sean, on the Bigger Podcast.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Well, if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe. You can find the Bigger Podcast through all the usual providers, and don't forget to visit our website at bigger.org.uk.